thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Martin Bodek, creator of the Festivus Haggadah and author of the new memoir, Zadie's War, Four Armies, Three Continents, Two Brothers, and One Man's Impossible Story of Endurance. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been discussing the question of belief in God and atheism lately in some of my classes and with friends and with my older children. It's an interesting discussion always and sometimes a challenging one. After all, I'm a rabbi. I do believe in God, which should be obvious, but isn't to everybody. When sophisticated thinking people tell me that they don't really believe in God, I usually ask, whenever they say that, which God don't you believe in? Sometimes the answer is, you know, the old man with the long white beard on a cloud, all that heaven and hell stuff. Well, that's kind of easy for me to answer. That's not the version of God I believe in either. But often the answer is a little more doctrinaire, something like, a modern person who understands science can't possibly believe in God. Or even, more people have been killed in religious wars than any other kind in human history. Since that's true, how can you believe in God or religion? Well, the last of those is pretty easy to answer because it's just factually untrue. If you look at the 20th century, far more people were killed in World War I and World War II, neither of which were religious wars, but were fought for territorial conquest and political ideology, than were killed in all the other wars in human history combined. I mean, that doesn't make religious war good, but let's be realistic. But the more important question is the one that focuses on how modern scientific people can still believe in God. After all, as one of my friends keeps telling me, in 2023, religion is not a growth industry in the United States. The statistics sort of bear this out. Membership in churches and synagogues has been declining nationally since at least 2007, and in some denominations, like conservative Judaism, for example, long before that. While America in 2023 remains a far more religious nation than any similarly civilized one in Europe, more and more people here, including many Jews, consider themselves to be religiously non-practicing. That is, they don't belong to a synagogue or church or mosque or gurdwara or temple, and they don't regularly pray or worship in any typical way. And while some may identify themselves as agnostics, unsure of their beliefs, others consider themselves to be downright atheists. Atheism is based in the idea that our universe was created randomly, that scientific explanations provide the answers, or eventually will provide the answers, to all our questions. But as the great physicist Werner Heisenberg, author of The Uncertainty Principle, winner of the Nobel Prize for his work in quantum physics in the 20th century, said, "The first gulp from the glass of natural sciences will turn you into an atheist. But at the bottom of the glass, God is waiting for you." I believe, as I always have, that science can provide the answers to so many of our what and how questions without ever providing any answers to our why questions. I personally find contemporary physics and cosmology to be fascinating and see many parallels to Jewish mystical teachings on the same subject. And while it's extremely important to remain engaged in this discussion and debate, I also think that the answer to this challenge to religion will come not from any ultimate solution to the intellectual problem, but from the ways in which we orient our own mainstream religious institutions to create real, warm, enveloping community. The truth is that very few people are atheists. While there might not seem like much difference between those who absolutely don't believe and those who just don't know, there is. Reminds me of a classic Woody Allen joke. I did not marry the first girl I fell in love with because there was a tremendous religious conflict at the time. She was an atheist, and I was an agnostic. Now, one thing worth noting about atheists, in a very real way, their belief that God does not exist is a kind of religious belief. In other words, they have the deeply held belief that there is no God. That can't be proven, of course. They can't prove that, but they firmly believe it. And sometimes they are evangelical in advancing their beliefs that God doesn't exist, at least in conversation, argument, and books. Now, we believers also can't prove that God does exist, but that doesn't prove that the opposite is true, now does it? Look, most of us lack the religious fervor for disbelief that characterizes true atheists. And for those who don't have a firm faith in God, there is a very healthy level of doubt, usually. Agnostics are more like the father at services with his teenage child who is asked by his son, "Dad, do you believe in God?" The father replies softly that he does not, prompting the next question, "Then why are we here?" And the father responds even more softly, "I've been wrong before." For those of us who do believe in God, who understand that a firm foundation in faith grounds us and permits us to weather the storms and challenges of life, accepting that doubt is a part of the makeup of most people is critical. And creating a warm, welcoming, loving environment in which faith flourishes is also essential. And after all, as my dad likes to say, atheists have no holidays. Which is not the only problem with being an atheist. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a very funny take on the biggest challenge about being an atheist.
You know, I listen to that song night after night, and I think, gee, religious people have such beautiful music and art, and atheists really have nothing. Until now. This is the entire atheist hymnal right here. A little tune called Atheists Don't Have No Song.
Christians have their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Hava Nagilas for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Romantics play
Clair de Lune.
Clair de Lune.
Born again, sing He is risen. But no one ever wrote a tune for godless existentialism.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing
a song of faith
in their songs.
They have a rule.
The He is always lowercase. The He is always lowercase.
Some folks sing
a baccantata.
Baccantata.
Lutherans get Christmas trees. Atheist songs add up to nada.
Up to nada.
But they do have Sundays free.
Have Sundays free.
Pentecostals sing.
They sing to heaven.
Sing to heaven.
Coptics have the Book of Scrolls. Numerologists count. They count to seven.
Five, six, seven.
Atheists have rock and roll.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing a song of faith in their songs.
They have a rule.
The He is always lowercase. The He is always lowercase.
Atheists
don't have no songs.
Christians have their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Hava Nagilas for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Catholics
dress up for Mass
and listen to
Gregorian chants.
Atheists
just take a pass.
Watch football in their underpants. watch football in their underpants.
Atheist.
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 Don't have no songs.
Don't have no songs.
That was comedian, actor, producer, and banjo player and singer Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers singing Atheists Have No Songs. Our guest on Too Jewish this morning is Martin Bodek, creator of the Festivus Haggadah, the Emoji Haggadah, the Coronavirus Haggadah, and the Shakespeare Haggadah, all made in very good fun. He's now also the author of a much more serious and extraordinary new memoir, Zadie's War, Four Armies, Three Continents, Two Brothers, and One Man's Impossible Story of Endurance. Hear this incredible tale when he joins us in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Martin Bodek has been writing books and articles and many other things for a long time. He has a new book out. It's called Zadie's War. He believes it's his most important book to date. You may know him from his remarkable Festivus Haggadah, among, I guess, a whole sort of sub-industry of Haggadot. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much for having me. Good morning to you as well.
So this is quite a departure from some of the stuff you've done before. Tell us what led you to write Zadie's War.
What led me to write the book was that it was in need of being written for a long time before I was ever even a writer. So I put out 10 books before I took this project off the shelf. And finally decided that it needed to be the light of day. But I needed some seasoning first in the publishing industry before I could go ahead and put this important work out there.
When writing a memoir like this, you know, obviously you, this wasn't going to be the splashy breakthrough book. But once you were able to convince a publisher that this was important, this is really a story that goes back a long way in your life. Tell us about your relationship with your Zadie.
My relationship with my Zadie was a wonderful, cordial, very close relationship. I spent summers with him before I even went to camp. I hung out with him when he was a chef in various camps in the Catskills. And besides for that, every morning I would daven late in Munkach in Borough Park on 14th Avenue and 49th or something like that. And I'd venture over to my grandfather's house for breakfast. And this was pretty much any time that I was off from school. Summers were spent with him. All major holidays were spent with him. Seder table was always with him. And he was a guiding light in my life. And throughout our entire relationship, he always shared with me tidbits of his World War II story. And I remember even as a child being absolutely fascinated and being very keenly aware that something was very unique about this story. You know, even as a 7 or 8 or a 9-year-old, something was way different, because I've heard plenty of other survival stories, Auschwitz stories, as a young man, as is habitable in our culture. But something was different about my grandfather's story. When he said that he served 4 armies, even before I was old enough to understand how one gets into an army, I knew that you could not serve in more than one.
Right. Right.
But 4 sounded big, so it was always sitting in my mind that I had to get the full story out of him. And eventually I did.
And we will continue with that story. The book is called Zadie's War by Martin Bodek. And it's a fascinating story. We'll learn more about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, wonderful Jewish synagogue in Catalina Foothills and Northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school registration is open now for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m. for services and Onik Shabbat, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, and then Kiddush afterwards, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Or you can come to the services on Facebook. Our Facebook page is BeitSimcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our musical services are in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. We have a new one starting, the Deuteronomy Project, Thursdays at lunchtime in person and on Zoom. You can access all of those through their website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and, of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish community in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18 at Gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. 888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, Tom, you know a lot about a part of the world that I really haven't been in much, the Balkans, which has a deep and complicated Jewish history, and everybody thinks it's really just a Jewish past, but you say there's actually a Jewish present and future going on in Serbia.
And other
and other parts
that
of the Balkans,
emerged
sorry.
From the former Yugoslavia.
Correct, yes. Sorry.
And the place that the Jewish community is most obviously growing, to my great surprise, is Bosnia. Sarajevo has always had a very solid Jewish community, even in the war years of the 1990s, when Sarajevo was being bombed by several different sides.
Yeah.
And I just recently saw a post from someone that I don't really know personally, but I know of, who's at least theoretically the head of the Jewish community in Sarajevo. And he was invited to a dinner that was held in Jerusalem this past week or so by the Jewish Agency for heads of Jewish communities from around the world. And some of those communities are better known and some are lesser known. But I've also found out from him and other Bosnian friends that there are much smaller cities. Sarajevo is the capital, so it's a big city. And even if it only has 2,000 Jews, it has marriages and bar and bat mitzvahs. And a lot of people who left to make aliyah are coming back from Israel these days for mostly economic reasons. So the Sarajevo community is one of the few major Jewish communities in Europe that's actually growing. But other communities are sort of coming out of the closet in much smaller places like Mostar, Forca, a couple other places that don't spring to mind right away, but smaller cities that most Americans have never heard of. Mostar, some people know about because of the bridge. But Mostar has an organized Jewish community. I mean, it's tiny. There might be 20 people there, but there's a head of that Jewish community. And these places are confident in their own future. They're confident that Bosnians from the large Bosnian diaspora will return. And I can attest to exactly how big that diaspora is, because whenever I'm in Bosnia and tell someone there that I'm from St. Louis, they have a big smile on their faces. And that's the capital of the world exile community of Bosnians. There's like 250,000 Bosnians in St. Louis.
In St. Louis?
Yeah. So, and that's my hometown. And it's very well known in Bosnia for hosting such a large Bosnian exile Expats. Refugee community.
Yeah.
And throughout the Midwest, I mean, recently I did an overnight at the Airport Hilton in Chicago. And my server at dinner was a woman from Bosnia. The next morning, the bartender in the airport, when I had like a coffee with Bailey's, was a Bosnian. And, you know, if there's any group of people who are happy to hear their native language, it's anybody from the Balkans. And you don't have to get their exact language correctly. You know, there are minor differences between Serbian, Croatian, Bosnian, whatever. They all have slight differences. But if you approximate any one of those languages, you just get this big smile and a big hug, and people feel clearly honored that you once went to the effort to learn something resembling their language.
It's funny how language makes us feel at home. It's really a powerful
right.
aspect. You know, in the same way that somebody speaks Yiddish or Hebrew to you in Shanghai or New Zealand or wherever you are, it changes your whole feeling about what's going on.
Right.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe is out shopping at the mall when he bumps into his friend Jake outside the jewelry store. Abe has a small gift wrap box in his hand. "Hi, Abe," says Jake. "What have you been buying?" "Well, to tell you the truth," says Abe, "it's my Miriam's birthday tomorrow. When I asked her what she wanted for her birthday, she said, 'Oh, I'll leave it up to you, darling. But how about something with lots of diamonds in it?'" "So tell me already, what did you buy her?" asked Jake. "I bought her 2 packs of playing cards," says Abe. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. You should live and be well, just for you, and get something with a lot of diamonds in it. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, last sections of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in quite different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, finally, two of the tribes, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. "We like the land we're traveling through now, right here." That is on the east bank of the Jordan, in what is today the nation of Jordan, long before the Arab peoples had even moved into the Middle East. The leaders of Reuben and Gad say, "Let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." And Moses agrees, but in curious language. First he tells them, "Build towns for your children and then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is clear. Families come first, our professions and income second. It is a human message, and one that we need to relearn in every generation. Put family first. Well, then, in the very last section of Numbers, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by a killing. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd committed the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were completely innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help much. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge, the sort of blood feuds Mark Twain described about the Hatfields and McCoys several millennia later, the kind of clan murder revenge cycles that take place even today in Palestinian Arab towns in the West Bank and Gaza. To preclude this kind of social disaster, the Torah portion of Maaseh provides for six cities of refuge in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle more than 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder, or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of murder and vengeance, we don't know. But we do know the Torah teaches us, in this very different way, that the most basic unit of society must be nurtured, maintained, protected, its positive values strengthened, even in the most trying of situations. A great message still. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Martin Bodek, will tell us how his grandfather, a pious Hasidic Jew from a small shtetl, managed to serve in four different nations' armies during World War II, and then survived, walking thousands of miles back home afterwards. Hear more of this amazing story when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Military staged a week-long incursion into the Jenin refugee camp last week with startling military results. Unlike the so-called Battle of Jenin 21 years ago, when widespread Palestinian troubles caused enormous difficulty for the IDF, this operation, called House and Garden by the military, resulted in extraordinarily few casualties for intense urban warfare. 13 Palestinian terrorists were killed, all identified as such by the IDF, and one Israeli soldier died, likely from friendly fire.
While there were civilians wounded and injured, the totals for a directed campaign in a densely populated urban area were extremely low, and no civilians died. The Jenin refugee camp has become a hotbed of Palestinian terrorist activity in recent months. Israel identified about 300 highly armed Palestinian terrorists, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad activists, as being present, integrated into a dense civilian population before the operation began. Faced with a carefully coordinated IDF campaign, including drones, armored vehicles, helicopters, tanks, small groups of infantry, most of the terrorists fled. Even the wounded totals were exceptionally low, especially compared to 2002, when 23 Israeli soldiers and over 50 Palestinians died. The military results are clear, and for all the bad press this one-week campaign generated internationally, it certainly worked. Israel has had 20 years to improve at modern urban warfare, and clearly it has. The Palestinian response, a terrorist attack by a West Bank Arab in Tel Aviv, ramming an automobile into a civilian crowd near a cafe and stabbing people with a knife, wounded 9 Israelis, 4 quite seriously, before an onlooker shot the guy to death. Ironically, that was close to the impact that 300 armed Palestinian terrorists had against the IDF in a week of large-scale fighting. Look, the Israeli army's performance in this campaign was impressive, and it demonstrated that Israel's military learns from its mistakes and has become even more capable of suppressing terrorists in the West Bank. The larger issue is that there seems to be no path towards avoiding this kind of campaign again in the future, perhaps the near future, a fact the Israeli government acknowledged after the end of the rapid campaign. Israel has now occupied the West Bank since 1967, and frankly, without unacknowledged Israeli support, the weak Fatah government of Abu Mazen would have fallen long ago to the more militant terrorists of Hamas, or perhaps now even Islamic Jihad. It's a lot to think that peace with these Palestinians can ever be arranged. But unless Israel wants to continue to devote huge resources to these kinds of operations on a pretty constant basis and pay the price in international PR and terrorism, there has to be some effort to find a way out of what seems like a permanent quagmire. In other news from Israel, the Netanyahu government's efforts to change the judicial system for its own favor seem stalled of late. They have been focusing on small bills to help their own people, including the ultra-corrupt Aryeh Deri, stay in power and therefore within the governing coalition. This fight is not over by any means, but the rapid effort to transform the Israeli judicial system has certainly been significantly slowed by the huge public resistance to the Likud effort to railroad it all through. In Russia, the former chief rabbi of Russia, Pinchas Goldschmidt, who now lives in Israel but remains the head of the European Organization of Rabbis, was labeled a foreign agent by Moscow. Goldschmidt left Russia after refusing to support Putin's invasion of Ukraine, and has warned the Jews who remain there that a broader anti-Semitic movement is afoot in Russia. He's urging them to emigrate as soon as possible. Many Jews from both Russia and Ukraine have made Aliyah in the last 17 months since the Russian invasion began in February 2022, finding a new home in Israel. Chabad Lubavitch has a closer relationship with Putin than Goldschmidt had, and their rabbis have stayed in Russia. But even Chabad's representatives have questioned the wisdom of the carnage created by Putin's war. We will see how long even they can hold out in Russia, which has a long and evil track record of deeply anti-Semitic policies and acts, from the Tsars and Cossacks to Stalin and the Refuseniks. And in Canada, the Anglican Church's Great Synod rather belatedly removed the prayers seeking the conversion of the Jews from its liturgy last week. There was a careful process of working with Canadian rabbis to repair the text. This follows systematic changes in Catholic and Episcopalian liturgies over recent years, as well as an apology by the Anglican Church in England for the long history of anti-Semitism in Christianity and within that church. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
Our brothers, the house of Israel.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Martin Bodek is the author of Zadie's War, Four Armies, Three Continents, Two Brothers, One Man's Impossible Story of Endurance, and it does in many ways seem like an impossible story. Martin Bodek has been writing for more than 20 years, primarily on Jewish topics. He is perhaps best known for his series of Haggadot, the Festivus Haggadah, the Coronavirus Haggadah, the Emoji Haggadah, I think the Shakespeare Haggadah. Did I miss any there?
You did not. Very good.
I've only edited one Haggadah, so I bow to your much more extensive collection. The book Zadie's War is not a comedic or... Well, not that those are silly necessarily, but this is not a parodic approach at all. It's a serious memoir about his grandfather. We mentioned he's from the Munkach Hasidim originally. Tell us a little bit about how, as you noted, one guy could end up in four different armies and somehow manage to survive the Second World War.
So I can give you the high-level speech of each of his stations. So at book talks... that I've frequented of late in support of the book, you know, I explain that in today's day and age, or in any day and age, if you are summoned to the army, you serve the country in which you were born or immigrated to.
Right.
And in some cases, you can be a lone soldier. The concept used to be entirely related to Israeli lone soldiers who have no support system, usually come from abroad. The definition has actually broadened to include now Ukrainian soldiers, people who are so compelled about the conflict there that they sign up. So this is pretty much the only way you could serve two armies in a lifetime. To push it to three or four would be a little beyond comprehension. But in a world that was on fire, strange circumstances happen. So my grandfather's first conscription was that he was a Romanian citizen, and as such, when he turned 18 in 1940, he was summoned to the Romanian army to complete his commission. So he was a Jew. Jews were not allowed to bear weapons or have any defensive weaponry on them or anything of the sort.
Right.
Because of the obviously racist overtones in enterprise. But he served out his year, and what he did during the year was menial labor. He basically built roads, built airport tarmacs, he told me, and other such things, and the various infrastructures of war and transportation. He was then sent home after a year of completing his work, and he went back to learning in the Beit Midrash, which is what he wants to do for the rest of his life. Then came the Anschluss, and it's very much debated, you know, how willing the parties were. If it was a congenial compact or if it was under duress. But in either case, Hungary annexed a part of Romania, and they annexed a part of Romania where my grandfather was living in the Transylvanian region. And once that Anschluss was secure, they went and redrafted everyone again. It was very much like when you move a town over and then all of a sudden you get summoned for jury duty.
Right.
So I imagine
Little worse than jury duty. I read those chapters in the book, and it's rough.
It's very rough. Yeah, he was manhandled, abused, and obviously because of his Jewish status and his friends were as well. But basically, he did the same exact task, but now for the Hungarian army, continuing to build these roads and runways and so forth. So that was the second army. So first we have the Romanian army, then we have the Hungarian army in an official capacity. Now, the third army happened when, in 1941, the Germans came around and selected from the Special Labor Service, I believe the exact name of this project was, the most hale and hearty, the most physically strong. And my grandfather was carted in a convoy of trucks to the front lines of Operation Barbarossa, For readers who are not aware of that is, Operation Barbarossa is and remains the largest land invasion in human military history.
A massive Nazi invasion of Soviet Union, right?
Yes. This assault happened on three fronts, north, middle, south. At the north, they tried to get to Moscow. At the middle, they tried to get to the middle parts of the country and towards the Ural Mountains. And in the south, they tried to get at the underbelly of Russia. So his job was to dig foxholes for the German troops in their assault against the Russian army. And I didn't really know where exactly he was at the time, but I took hints from what he was describing as to where he was. And I believe he was in the south column, because he described to me that every day he would go back to the same barracks after a day in the field and of dodging bullets. The only way that could happen is if the line did not move. And indeed, in the southern column, it did not move. The Germans came very close to capturing and sieging Moscow completely, but they didn't complete the task. And they did make headway along the middle of the country, but it did not move in the southern region. It was well defended. So that's where my grandfather was. And after enough, this was his third army because he was enslaved by the German army. One day he decided he'd seen enough of his comrades fall. My grandfather described that he was literally dodging bullets left and right. So in the middle of the night, when the guards, he called it the Wach, when the Wach was looking the other way, he escaped with a Czech friend of his and made it into the Russian countryside, where he foraged for food for months. And one day, and my grandfather described it very dramatically, he was with his head inside of a garbage can looking for what might be available to be eaten in there. He brought up his head and he was staring down the barrel of a gun. So a Russian soldier had captured him and captured a bunch of his friends who he had collected along the way and who was sleeping with in barns. And they transported him to a military camp called Angurst. I do not know where this place is. There is a region to the right of the Black Sea where I found an Angurst sports team and many people with the surname Angurst, and that is the only clue that I have to the possible location of this place. The Russian Gulag has been well established and recorded where all the satellite locations were, but the military camp installments are absolutely nowhere to be found. So I would love to find this place. The research is still ongoing, but I did publish the book, even though some pieces of information weren't in hand. In any case, he was now a subject of the Russian army, and what he did for them was serve the troops. He would bear water for them, chop wood for them, clothe them, and he was basically a shamash for the Russian army.
Right.
After a few months, he was transported north to very close to the Arctic Circle to a camp called Khrinol, he called it. And the area was Kirovsky Oblast. And in this encampment, where he spent the last 3.5 years of his World War II experience, the job was to chop wood. Not just for the Jewish, for the Russian troops, but for the economy. They would chop wood, they would sell this wood, they would send it down the Volga River towards Moscow, where they would process this and fund their war. And he's not yet serving, actually, the Russian army. He's still enslaved. So what happened was, towards the end of the war, as kind of is happening now, Russia ran out of personnel and weaponry. So what happened was, with about 2 months to go to what would eventually be the end of the war, the Russian commander said that anyone who was part of our slave corps could sign up and become one of us and serve in the war and then in the royal fight against the Axis. And if you do so, you will earn your freedom. So my grandfather did so. and took a few months of basic training, and was promoted to private. And this is how you serve a Fourth Army. And the end of his World War II story is that it was May 5th. Hitler had shot himself in the head on April 30th. And now the task was to break the Germans' backs in Berlin. As the Allies were coming in from the West, the Americans and the British, and as the Russians were streaming in from the East and pinching them at the Battle of Berlin. So my grandfather was given his assignment, and his assignment was to kill Nazi troops on site. That was it. There was nothing complicated about the objective. It was the simplest thing you could possibly imagine. So they started the convoy on May 5th. They reached the border of Germany on May 8th, when the entire convoy stopped. And my grandfather was ready. He was ready to kill, literally. But the announcement from the commander of the line was Germany had surrendered. So he said,
it's an amazing story.
I know. And
it doesn't end then, of course.
Oh, it doesn't end there at all. So it was a big holiday and a big yumtiv, he called it. They made an about face, went back to the camp in Kirovsky Oblast near the Arctic Circle, and it was released officially. But they obviously were not going to give him transportation home.
Okay.
So he took a 1,600-mile hike south back to his country of Romania.
He walked all the way.
He walked. He gathered together 150 of his friends, put provisions onto their back. Literally, I imagine, like, you know, Winnie the Pooh with a little broomstick and a little bag in the back. And they just hiked.
Wow.
And of the 150, several passed away along the way, because obviously a 1,600-mile hike is not very easy.
No.
And some of his friends peeled off to their places of origin, and my grandfather made it home. And that is how you serve four armies.
It's an incredible story that he survived even one of those early army experiences, which were frankly extremely abusive.
Yes.
And ended up not only surviving, but making it home by the end of the war, well, after the war. Tell us a little bit, because as you said, the story doesn't end there. Just, we have a couple of minutes left. Tell us a little bit about the rest. I know the story, the book is called Zadie's War, but give us a little bit of the continuation of the story without giving away too much.
Okay, well, one centerpiece is the last night before he was to head home. This was the story that he told me through my youth that completely fired up my imagination. And I knew that this was the piece I needed to get right as I was telling it to the public. So this is what happened. So they reached the mountain ridge. After months and months of traveling together, 140 of his friends had either passed away or found their way home, and 10 men were left. And they decided they're going to rest here for the night, and tomorrow we're going to head back home. So my grandfather had become something of a foraging expert through his experience throughout the war. And one of his skills was to know which mushrooms are safe to eat and which are not. Point in fact, 20% of mushrooms are edible and 80% are poisonous. So he knew the varieties. So they wanted a little meal to have before they went to bed for the night. Well, not bed, went to the ground for the night. And they gathered together a bunch of mushrooms and they made themselves a little soup out of it. My grandfather tried to object, knowing what he knew, being the expert that he was at this point, but they wouldn't listen to him. They were hungry. So they decided to have the fare, and my grandfather sat that out. And in the morning, he was the only person who woke up.
Wow.
And just, I, Yes.
No, I was going to say it's a series of incidents. And look, anybody who survived the Shoah or to some degree the militaries of World War II, there's always a remarkable story. But there's here it's like a set of cliffhangers in which he survived. Tell us, Martin, where people can find out more about the book, Zadie's War, where they can find out more about you.
You can go to my blog, martinbodek.com. You can find me all over social media, just by searching my name. It's available in bookstores, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I am appreciative of all reviews left for my work, very much. There's my plug right there. Bloggers have picked it up and given it some very nice reviews. That pretty much covers it, I think. But you can find me on social media. I'm very, very not shy.
Martin, thank you so much. I should note the pictures of this, you know, Munkacher, you know, dressed in full Hasidic garb. And, you know, you think, oh, this is a pious man who's never done anything. Not true at all. Really a fascinating story. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me. I much appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, live in person and available on our Facebook page. To play us out this morning, here's Israeli star Idan Amedi and his song Yavo Machar, Tomorrow Will Come. Lots of stuff may happen, good, bad, but tomorrow will come, and I promise it'll be better. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
ימים חולפים ואיפה הם לפעמים אני שואל מדוע ומתי נשכב לנוח מתי נודה על מה שיש ימים חולפים ואין ברור עומדים בין צער ושמחות לנוח ולחבק את הגעגוע להתקרב לומר אמת לפעמים אל המזל סוגר לנו את היד לפעמים הכל לטובתנו לפעמים את נעלמת בלי לומר דבר לפעמים שמיים מאירים עלינו תסתכלי אני מבטיח ש את מה שאפשר גם אם לפעמים חשוך אני מבטיח שיבוא מחר ימים חולפים ומה אפשר תראי עובר, הופך עבר ברגע אולי זו התרופה לפגע ללב שלך זה שנסגר ימים חולפים ואין ברירות נלמד בין צער ושמחות לנו ולחבק את הגעגוע עד שנתקרב נאמר אמת כי לפעמים אל המזל סוגר לנו את היד לפעמים הכל לטובתנו לפעמים את נעלמת בלי לומר דבר לפעמים שמיים עיניים מאירים על שנינו תסתכלי אני מבטיח ש אתן מה שאפשר וגם אם לפעמים נראה חשוך אני מבטיח שיבוא מחר
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.